This first story on our show today is very unusual. It wasn't originally made to be broadcast on any radio show. It was a tape made by somebody who'd never put anything together for radio. He made it to give to a friend. Here's what happened. Back in July of 1999, Jake Warga heard that somebody who he was close to back in college, his friend Brian, had tried to kill himself. Jake went out to visit Brian, and he took with him this mini disc recorder that he had just bought for himself. It had this little clip-on microphone. During his visit with Brian, they recorded this long conversation that they had. And when Jake got back home, he decided to edit this down and give it to Brian as a present. He had no idea how to actually edit sound or do anything like that, so at some point, he jumped onto the internet and found a website, one actually that we've mentioned on our show in the past, called transom.org, that teaches beginners how to edit and mix audio. It has links to free editing software and all that kind of thing. So Jake put together the story that you're about to hear, and he sent it to Brian. His hope was that if Brian heard this tape, heard himself talking, heard his own words, it might convince him that he shouldn't try to kill himself again. That didn't work. Here's the tape that Jake put together.
Last year, my friend Brian tried to commit suicide. He had checked himself into a new hotel that runs alongside the interstate, which happens to pass through the small college town in which he lives. And without ceremony or note writing, he took a combination of drugs he thought sufficient enough to quietly end his life. As people often do, Brian and I started getting lazy about communicating after I left college and moved out of that same college town. Emails became rare and phone calls rarer. After the longest period yet of not hearing from Brian, I got a call from an old mutual friend of ours asking if I had seen or heard from him. I said I had not. We made calls and eventually found him safe in the hospital. A few weeks later, I arranged a visit to see how my old school and Brian had changed in the years I had been away. And when I came to visit, we sat for 3 hours on a park bench late one summer night. He was still in the process of piecing together exactly what had happened. This is Brian.
Let's talk about you.
No, there's not much to talk about.
Oh, did you... You were going to go to the hospital today, right?
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I... the woman in the records department made a photocopy of my... of my medical records from that... when I got admitted, and... there wasn't anything too... surprising or... anything in there, but it was still interesting to read. So, but they said I was discovered at approximately 6 p.m. I guess this was the next day.
6 p.m.?
Yeah, I don't know why.
They
yeah, because I should have checked out around noon or I guess, but I was, they said I was unconscious and unresponsive. I was reading the paramedics report, and I was pale, cold, and clammy, and I was breathing only 6 respirations per minute, which is very slow. And they said they found pill bottles and a bottle of alcohol in the room, and they cleared my airway and started administering oxygen. Then they gave me a 2 milliliters IV of something called Narcan, which is a antidote for opiates like morphine.
Do you think it would have worked?
I think it would have, and I mean, maybe I didn't take enough. Because, I mean, morphine is very serious. It's a very hardcore It's very easy to OD on it.
It's hardcore, man.
And I guess it was like really late that night or even early the next morning when I guess they were about to transfer me and I woke up and the attendant who wrote this report said I said I was disappointed to be alive and that I had passed out before I could take the morphine. And that part I do remember really vaguely. I remember waking up and feeling the nasal cannula in my nose giving me oxygen and seeing the IV bottle hovering over me. And the guy asked me kind of sarcastically, it sounded, so are you glad to be alive? And I'm pretty sure I remember saying no.
Brian doesn't have that many friends. He's good looking and funny, yet something inside prevents him from being confident in social skills. For example, it took a long time in our friendship before he told me, and I felt confident in asking, about his biological mother. He told me she died when he was young, that she had committed suicide. His father remarried soon after and raised Brian and his brother, who is now a doctor.
Although there seemed to be some incongruities with the reports, I guess those paramedics and hospital staff can really hastily fill stuff out. They can really take a lot of license. My own mom's coroner's report was really, it had some gross inconsistencies in it, or errors. My brother says coroners often just make stuff up if they can't find, you know, certain causes, like cause of death, I guess.
Are you hoping to find similarities between your mom's report and your report?
Oh. No. I hadn't really thought of that. I brought her up just because they made some errors on hers, just like they had with mine. But with me, I don't think it was anything really major.
About a week prior to this interview, Brian was arrested in San Francisco for possession of narcotics. Brian does not use drugs or alcohol. He had gone to the same bad part of town to buy the same drugs with the intent of trying again. I asked him about this trip to San Francisco.
What were you doing there?
Same thing.
Same cocktail?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
But it didn't work before.
I'm too much of a wimp to try other things, like other things that might be more violent, but less immediate. I don't want to, you know, I don't like violence in practice.
I've read that suicide is a selfish act, yet I've never really thought of Brian as selfish. But I can understand why the relatives of suicide victims might go through that angry phase, that phase when they place the blame on the person who killed themselves, to help with any feelings of guilt they might have. I asked Brian if he thought what he did was selfish.
I say it's selfish in the same sense that going to a therapist is selfish. You have a problem and you're doing something about it. You're doing something about it in the way you feel like, you know, coping with it. In the end, people should live for other people. They should really live for themselves. Just like you shouldn't go to school for a decade, you know, to become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, just because your parents want you to be that. you know, because you want to do it. Your parents want you to do it. You should live your life as you want, as you see fit. And it doesn't necessarily mean you haven't considered other people's reactions. It just means that maybe you have, and you've decided that unfortunately you still want to go forward with it. I mean, I don't want to spend the rest of my life alive and miserable just because someone else doesn't want me to die. I don't see much sense to that.
In an effort to catch up on letter writing, Brian would occasionally write long emails filled with wit, humor, and sometimes desperation. He is an excellent writer. I asked him why he didn't write a suicide note.
Yeah, I'll admit that was rather selfish. I mean, I know that people were wondering what the heck is up. I could have sat down for probably what would have been several hours to type something up. I just really, at that point in time, I was just very fed up and impatient, and just wanted it all to end. I just didn't want to screw around with anything else. Could have also cleaned my room first, too.
As we were talking, an ambulance passed by in no particular hurry.
There's what I probably wrote in. Cost over $800 to be transported from... Yeah. According to their timetable, it took them 8 minutes to get from there to there.
I guess that's pretty good.
That's appreciable distance, I guess. It's worth 8 minutes. 2 milligrams, 2 tiny milligrams of Narcan opiate anhedone is $6.
As I write this, I wonder if I'm making Brian's note for him. Am I documenting the story for him, or for whom he might leave behind? This was not the first time he tried committing suicide, and in light of his recent arrest, not his last.
Do you think he found the only way to cope?
The only viable way, so to speak. I don't get the impression most people are that happy anyway, you know. They just kind of grind their way through life, and they'll have kids, and that'll give them an artificial reason to live for a while, and then the kids grow up and forget about them, and I know the mind is a really powerful thing, you know, it's, people can do just about anything they really put their minds to, but it's, it also takes a tremendous amount of self-motivation. As my therapist says, it has to come from within. And it doesn't feel like there's much within, you know.
What's your relationship with death?
I was brought up in a Protestant family, you know, as a Lutheran. So, and I haven't renounced that faith. I just feel I've stumbled in a big way, and I haven't gotten up, or haven't been able to get up. And I'm hoping that I'll just go to heaven after I die. But of course there is a lingering fear of hell, you know. Because it's highly stigmatized. Suicide. But I don't think I believe in sins that are, what do you call it? Cardinal, yeah. I think it's just something that, it's just another kind of sin. My cousin Amy, who's an atheist, told me that her dad, who's a Lutheran minister, told her that if you kill yourself, you go to hell because you're not alive to repent and ask forgiveness for that sin. So therefore, since you have not repented for that sin, you'll go to hell. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, just think of all the sins you haven't repented for in your life, even if you tried to. I know you haven't tried to, but... So, you know, I do have a fear of dying. But it doesn't always outweigh my other fears or my other...
Fear of living?
Yeah.
After sitting at a park bench for so long, and after Brian confessed to having talked more than he ever has, we were more than overdue for a stretch. And after a while of walking around aimlessly, we picked up our old habit of train spotting and penny smashing.
Jeez.
Quick.
I would have loved to, I probably shouldn't run with this thing. But I don't know if it can record with, you know, while being jostled.
It'll catch up.
We are now running to try to catch the train. We're running past lions. We're now up on the tracks. Here come the lights.
At this point, Brian and I are running alongside the train as it's beginning to stop at the nearby station.
I wish you would step back from that ledge, my friend. You could cut ties with all the lies that you've been living in. And if you do not want to see me again, I would understand.
Well, train's here. No pennies.
Shit. Oh, brother.
I don't.
I have a penny.
Yeah.
Or two.
Give
it up. Give it up, homeboy. Anything else?
Do you ever cry?
No. I hardly remember the last time. It's probably been almost 10 years. I came close, though, in December of 92 when I came home after visiting my grandma for over Christmas time. My grandma had shown us a bunch of pictures of my biological mom and told us some stories about her. These were photos I don't think I'd ever seen and stories I don't think I'd ever heard. So I came home and I was taking a shower late that night, and while I was in the shower, I really, you know, I wept just a little bit, but it wasn't really full-fledged. Kind of feel like I'm emotionally constipated. I guess that's one a major part of my problem. People need to express their anger and their, you know, whatever else they're feeling. I've actually tried to. I've tried to, because I knew, I wanted the release, because I knew it would feel good, but I just couldn't do it. Very frustrating.
Well, in the last 9 minutes of this cassette.
Oh, there's 9 more minutes.
Killing it over now.
I can't think of anything else to say. I'm not the kind of guy who can just rattle off his famous last words or big words with words of advice. I guess don't have kids unless you had a good relationship with your own parents, I guess. Because you can seriously screw them up by saying negative things to them or even neglecting them. Apparently that's a highly debated cause of sudden infant death syndrome. Not giving your baby enough physical attention. One of my psychiatrists said I'm failing to thrive. That's a phrase commonly used for infants who mysteriously die. I'm thinking, you know, I've just kind of amused myself with the thought that my case is a belated case of sudden infant death syndrome. And I don't think my dad failed as a parent, as he worries that he has. He's just, I think he did a great job. He just, along the way, I contracted a disease, and it doesn't have a very optimistic or bright prognosis. And, you know, not even the best parent can prevent that.
At the end of editing this story, Brian is still alive, living in the same small town. I don't know if he's getting better or not.
Jake Warga. He sent this tape to his friend Brian in 1999, and he waited for a reaction. Brian emailed him. He wrote, "How did you learn about the music you included in the interviews? I especially like the Moby pieces, but don't you think those solemn, dirge-like harmonies might be a tad overdramatic?" Brian wanted to know if Jake's computer had a filter that could make him sound, quote, like less of a retard. Brian also asked Jake if he had any plans to publish the story. He told Jake that he thought that Jake would have an easier time publishing it if he were dead. Nearly 2 years later, in the spring of 2001, Brian did try to kill himself again. And this time he succeeded. Jake added this epilogue to the story.
On May 9th of this year, Brian's body was found in his room. He had injected himself with a lethal dose of morphine. He was 31 years old. I had sent this tape to Brian sometime after our interview in hopes that by hearing himself, like looking long and hard into a mirror, he would realize what he was saying, that he would snap out of it. Though he appreciated my efforts, I did not change him, and I came closer to realizing I never could. Brian left packets for a few people, myself included. In them were copies of letters he wrote years before, explaining some of what he felt at the time, and tapes of the interview we did that night. He actually had to make cassette copies for his brother and cousin from the mini-discs that I sent him. I've had to ask myself, now that Brian's dead, why do I want to share this tape? One reason is I want to take something from death, to rob it, for a little while, of the mute it imposes. I also hope that it might help someone who feels like Brian, or for friends and family left confused, some sense of closure they may not have had if death were allowed its silence. So Brian, I'm relieved your pains are over, and now it's time for ours to begin. You will be missed.
Jake Warga in Seattle. Thanks to Jay Allison and Transom.org and KUOW in Seattle, where Brian's story has appeared.